From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Remember a few weeks ago when I got a little sappy talking about the magic of seeds? Well, if you need a serious dose of wonder in your life this week, I have just the story for you. Imagine finding a 2,000-year-old seed. Now imagine your surprise when it sprouts. Turns out, it can happen.
The idea is that seeds become dormant, but they don't necessarily die, and that therefore they can be regenerated.
That's Dr. Sarah Salon, part of an Israeli team that managed to grow 7 Judean date palms from 2,000-year-old seeds. They've even named them Adam, Jonah, Uriel, Boaz, Judith, Hannah, and Methuselah. Dr. Sarah Salon and her team first tried to germinate the seeds in 2005. 15 years later, actual fruit. Welcome to the show, Dr. Salon.
Well, good evening.
I understand that the first seed that sprouted was dubbed Methuselah. How surprised was your colleague, Dr. Soloway, who was babying the seed, that it actually sprouted?
Well, you have to ask her, my dear. Something only Elaine can tell you in her own inimitable way. But she was on the phone, you know, the same morning that she went down to the greenhouse and saw this tiny, tiny little shoot. And she was on the phone within minutes to me and saying, "Sarah, there's something there. There's something there. Wake up. It's still 6 o'clock in the morning." So she was, I think, very excited. And so was I.
What is the significance of the name Methuselah?
Okay, well, in Hebrew, we say Methuselah. He's the oldest person mentioned in the Bible. I think in the book of Genesis, you know, when they give the various, he begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, with all their years. Now, Methuselah is the ancestor, eventually, of Abraham, but he lives 900 years. In those days, they seem to live hundreds and hundreds of years.
So where did the seed that became Methuselah come from?
The seed that became Methuselah came from archaeological excavation of Masada. Masada is a fortress. It's very well known. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Israel. It overlooks the Dead Sea, and it's a mountain overlooking the Dead Sea that King Herod made into a fortress more than 2,000 years ago.
And it was a place in which very important events happened.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, absolutely. Masada's got a fascinating history that we know about. And the story is, of course, that the Zealots, a sect of Jews who were violently against the Roman occupation at that time, basically took over the site. There was a Roman garrison there. After King Herod died, the place became a garrison for the Romans, and the Zealots took it over. They overwhelmed the garrison, and with their wives and children, they set up a rebel base camp, if you like, high above the Dead Sea. And it took the Romans a couple of years, really, to get them out of there. And basically, the night before the Roman legions burst in was the eve of the Passover, Pesach, as we say. And they made a deal with themselves and their leader that they would each kill their family, and the last two people alive would then, the last one would kill the last one, and then he would take his own life. And Herod had built extensive stores for food, and the Zealots burned it all except, according to Josephus, one food store which they left intact, because they didn't want the Romans to think that they had taken their own lives because they were starving and they were under siege by the Romans. They wanted to show that they had burned the food and that they had preferred to die as free people, free men and women. But they left this one food store intact. And 2,000 years later, when Yigal Yadin, Israel's very famous archaeologist, was excavating the site of Masada, they came across the food stores and they found thousands and thousands and thousands of seeds, not only date seeds, but other seeds as well, scattered over the area between what they called the food stores and the Northern Palace. And they were everywhere. And some of them were carbonized. They had been burned in a fire, but many were not. So he gathered all of them. And 60 years later, I managed to get access to that collection of seeds, which had been burned that night on Matsada 2,000 years ago on the eve of the Passover.
It's an extraordinary story. Your colleague, Elaine Soloway, to whom you've referred, is an expert in arid agriculture, and you're a pediatric gastroenterologist.
Yeah, we get on very well together, even though.
How did each of you contribute to the research?
Well, you see, I'm trained as a medical doctor and a pediatrician, and I did my hard labor in that subject for about 30 years. And then about 20 years ago, I set up this research center for natural medicine, which had nothing to do with pediatrics. I just really was very, very interested in the whole concept of healing, and particularly the role of plants and medicinal plants, and particularly the role of ancient medical traditions like the Chinese system, the Indian systems of Ayurveda or Siddha. The Tibetan system is something I'm particularly interested in. And of course, the system of this country itself and the use of the plants and of how this Israel's plants were used for thousands of years. So I kind of transformed from being a doctor to becoming something of an ethnobotanist. And from becoming interested in plants and trying to record the traditional uses of the plants of this country, I got interested not only in their uses, but also conserving them, if you follow me. And we discovered, Elaine and I, that many of the plants were endangered or very rare, and many were extinct. So Elaine started growing them. I would go and collect seeds, and Elaine started growing them. We called it the Middle Eastern Medicinal Plant Project. And then I figured, why not look at things that are no longer here, that are completely extinct. And I thought a good place to find extinct plants would be archaeological sites and look at the botanical remains. And that's just what I did. And Elaine has got magic hands. She can grow anything. And she used some tricks that farmers use to wake up seeds. You know, certain hormone solutions and warming them, and she managed to do it.
Let's talk about the fruit that came from Methuselah. What did it taste like? What does it look like? What kind of date is it? Is there anything modern that we can compare it to?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So the ancient Judean dates were particularly noted for their size, some varieties, for their particular flavor, for their long storage life. They were, I think, pretty dry, and they could be sent all the way around the Roman Empire. Now, when we tasted Hannah for the first time last week, Hannah's fruits, it was quite dry. It was pretty sweet, but not as sweet as Majul. It had a kind of very chewy texture, not syrupy and sticky, but sort of chewy. And it had this lovely after flavor. I can only compare it to honey. Everybody said, can we have another one? We didn't have that many. Oh, can we have another one there? And I said, well, actually, no, you can't. But they had a very interesting taste. Now, I'm not a date tasting expert, but there are people on Kibbutz Keturah who are date tasting experts, and date experts full stop. And when we gave the dates to them, because we did questionnaires last week asking people's reaction to the date, you know, how sweet do you find it? How sour do you find it? What kind of aftertaste does it have? How does it compare to other dates that you know? I mean, we did 20 questions for a lot of people. And the date experts said, you know, they really, you know, they smelt it, and then they chewed a little bit, and And then they said, it's got a flavor of a zahidi. And the zahidi dates come from Iraq. So I showed them in our publication what they call the phylogenic tree. Where does Hannah fit in with all the other date varieties? And they analyzed all of our date's genetic background. And Hannah fits right in there with the Iraqi varieties. She's not next to Zahidi, but she's very close to Zahidi. So her genetics is very Iraqi, or as we should say, Babylonian or Mesopotamian.
This is such an extraordinary story. Part of what you're studying must have great philosophical implication for you. I feel like right now in this time that is so difficult that we're living through, that having a seed, a 2,000-year-old seed, sprout, become a tree, and bear fruit is a very hopeful, a very hopeful thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's kind of like a ray of light in this dark time, and it is a dark time. The world is changing, and not in a good way. Species are becoming extinct, and the climate is changing, and so many things are unstable. And in all this kind of degradation of nature, something that we thought was dead is actually alive. And it's come to fruition, and it's even produced this remarkable fruit. And that to me is a kind of hope. It's like somebody saying, in all these dark times, there's hope.
Well, I want to thank you. It's just the work that you're doing is so interesting. And this story, I think, brings us a lot to marinate on during these times.
Well, thank you very much, Evan, for taking the time to phone me up at this late hour. I hope you've enjoyed it. I have.
Me too. That's Dr. Sarah Salin from the Lewis Borick Natural Medicine Research Center at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. She and a colleague are bringing back date palms from seeds recovered from the excavation of Masada, seeds that are 2,000 years old. Coming up, want to meet the new babka king of LA? Well, so did I. So I called him up to talk about how he's modernizing some very old traditions. Stay with me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Babka, just say the word and the mouth begins to ready and you want to start water to boil for coffee or tea. I've made my own, riding the wave of Ottolenghi's Jerusalem cookbook, struggling with the stuffed cut dough as I coaxed it into a braid, then wondering if I've gone overboard as I spooned sugar syrup onto the cooked beauty. When I saw Shimi Aaron's creations on Instagram, I knew I needed to know more. The Israeli baker was recently crowned the future babka king of LA by restaurant critic Bill Addison. Hi, Shimi.
Hi, Yvonne. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So nice to talk to you.
How long have you been in LA?
I recently moved to LA, so about 7-8 weeks, approximately.
Oh, really new?
Very, very new. It's something that I think in the back of my mind, I always knew that will happen, even when I lived in New York for quite a long time in New York, about 14 years. But you know how New Yorkers are. We never think we're going to move to L.A. So it took me a few years to do that. And I ended up in Europe for a few years and decided to move back to America. I missed America. And I missed, just the weather in Los Angeles is so fantastic and reminding me of Tel Aviv. I think in general, just the nature of the place reminds me of Tel Aviv, the driving part, the weather, the beach, and also the people in a way.
So are you making it work for yourself just on babka, or are you personal chefing as well?
No, I'm personal chefing, and you know, since the whole babka took off, which, you know, just caught me off guard, because I really had no idea that this is gonna get to this level, and yeah, but I'm able to just do the whole thing together. I sleep, you know, 4 hours a night, and I wake up at 5:30 in the morning, and I stay up till almost 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm very, very humbled and very, very happy that it, you know, it's just gotten to this level.
So let's talk about babka. What makes a babka a babka and not just another coffee cake?
The way it started was, you know, women was making challah bread for Shabbat dinner, and they just used the leftovers of the dough to stuff it with fruit and some sugar and cinnamon and just rolled it and turned it into a cake. And the name babka is grandmother, which I'm very lucky to still have my grandmother alive. She just turned 101 this year. So, yeah, so it means a lot of things to me. But I think the history is just so important, especially being Jewish and especially, you know, coming from Israel and not living in Israel and, you know, maintaining the heritage and, you know, and the culture. And not that I grew up on babka, because I'm Sephardic and my parents, you know, are from the Middle East, but I was exposed to it and I literally fell in love with it. I got really attached to this cake. It's almost like I literally talk to the cake, if that's crazy. But I always wish them well before I put them into the oven, because I do love them, you know. It's my babies now.
They're such an interesting cake because they have the texture of challah. Some are more rich, even more like a brioche. But then they have the filling, which I think a lot of people are very partial to the chocolate ones. And this vertical braid, which makes it look very different and changes the texture of it. A lot of yours are baked on a sheet pan, so they don't have the support of the sides, which makes them look different. It kind of emphasizes the layers of the braid. Can you talk a little bit about what the texture of yours is like?
Absolutely, absolutely. So my best friend from England, you know, his name is Aaron Tibby, and he's a really, really, really major chef in England. And I was lucky enough to spend a lot of time with him while I was in England. And he's making his babkas like this, not exactly the same way that I make them, but he taught me that it needs to have its own space and you don't need to limit it. It needs to just go everywhere, and whatever it decides to do, it should do. And I think when he said that, it made sense to me, because I don't like perfect things. I like imperfections. And I think we live in a world where everything needs to look so perfect. And, you know, you talked about Instagram and pictures. I do want to make beautiful things, and I want to make tasty, beautiful things, and I want to make things that are photographed well. But I think imperfections, I mean, in everything in life, is the most beautiful thing. And they come to life when I just let them be on a trend, don't limit it.
So talk to us about some of the variations you do. I know you do one with like a halva-ish kind of sesame cream or paste.
Yes, I do. I do tahini cream with honey and roasted pecans. And sometimes I involve some saffron in it, in the dough, actually. When I, you know, I use the water, I just use some saffron in the water of the dough, and it gives it like this spice, you know, it gives it something really, really nice, this like kick. And I just love halva. Like growing up, halva was, you know, it was my candy. I grew up in the Middle East, I grew up in Israel, and halva was everywhere when I was growing up. And I think the combination of halva and chocolate is so delicious. As a child, you know, I remember my mom used to buy challah bread, And she used to bring it home. And the first thing I used to do was to take like chocolate spread, like a really, really inexpensive, not very tasty chocolate spread and some tahini and just mix the whole thing with honey. And when I created this babka, I thought, this is like my childhood dream. Like, this is what I loved as a child. And this is what I want to create for other people to have, you know, in a much more luxurious way. But still the same flavors that I grew up on. Again, going back to history, this is what I want to give people. You know, I want to give people a part of my history as a child growing up in Israel with a mother who cooked and baked her entire life.
Well, it's been so lovely to have this conversation and get to know you a little bit. And one day I hope I get to taste a babka. Thank you so much, Shimi.
Yes, you will. Thank you very much. Thank you for that.
That's Chef Shimi Aaron. Follow him on Instagram to ogle the beautiful babkas or take one of his babka classes on Zoom. We've got all the links on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. So if you're like me and we're too late to order your babka for this year's Rosh Hashanah, rest assured there are other opportunities to fill your holiday table. Jillian Ferguson takes us to the farmer's market where one chef is shopping for a Rosh Hashanah-inspired pop-up.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We're back in Santa Monica this week with Chef Elizabeth Heitner, who has an exciting new weekend pop-up at Melody Wine Bar, where she's been serving a Mexican-inspired Jewish menu. And Elizabeth, I first found out about you from reading about your pastrami tacos, but this weekend you have a special Rosh Hashanah menu. Give us a sneak peek of what you're going to be cooking.
So the menu is going to be all your favorite Rosh Hashanah dishes. We have a masa ball soup. Sherry from Tehachapi Grain, she has a really special dent corn masa that I'm making into a masa ball instead of using traditional matzah.
I love that.
Oh, thanks. And actually, it's quite similar to caldo de pollo in Mexican cuisine, that it's the soup that your mom would make if you're ever feeling sick, kind of like how masa ball soup was for me growing up.
Great. And so what kind of vegetables can we find?
I'm doing a potato latke. It's served with mole amarillo and a fresh apple salad with cilantro, lime, olive oil. It's almost like a more spicy, complex version of the latke we grew up eating with applesauce and sour cream.
Are you also still making the simis?
I am making the carrot simis. That's actually one of my favorite dishes that I'm making right now, because it just reminds me so much of my family. That was the dish we had every year for Rosh Hashanah, and it really just reminds me of being at home.
For people who didn't grow up eating simis, tell us what it is.
Traditionally, it's a roasted carrot dish with sweet potatoes and prunes, and they're roasted in orange juice and honey. Very earthy, very significant of the autumn produce that we're about to see right now. So it's very sweet, very homey, and very comforting.
Yeah, and so are you recreating your childhood dish, or are you putting your own spin on it?
It would definitely be my own spin. It's using the beautiful Tamay baby carrots. The carrots are so sweet and have such an amazing texture. They get roasted in orange juice, served over some sweet potato puree, and a salsa matcha, which is a Mexican sesame seed sauce with a little bit of chili. So it just adds spiciness and earthiness to the dish that it didn't have before.
And does the salsa matcha also add a little bit of crunch?
Absolutely. It's super crunchy. You can also make it with nuts, but I prefer to make it with sesame seeds.
I'm curious, as a chef, you know, Rosh Hashanah is all about sweetness. Do you really lean into that and try to amplify sweetness when you're doing it yourself? Or do you try to balance that with other flavors?
I for sure try to balance it, because one thing that I didn't like growing up in the simis was the prunes. Just as a young kid, it was a little bit scary for me to be eating prunes, just a huge bite of sweetness. So just to contrast that sweetness, right now I'm doing segmented oranges just to bring some freshness and lightness to the dish. But I am doing an apple babka that's very sweet with a honey glaze that really will remind you of your mom's apple honey cake that you used to have as a kid.
And is it a la carte, or do people need to order in advance?
Well, we do accept orders to go if you just call ahead and you can place your order. It's a first come, first serve. You pretty much just wait in line until a table is ready. And it's outdoor seating. It's so beautiful. You can bring your dog. It's such a lovely space.
Sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Heitner. You can find her at Melody Wine Bar in Virgil Village, Saturday through Monday from 5 to 10 p.m., and she'll be back next weekend with her pastrami tacos. Mike Cerrone is the farmer that Elizabeth buys her apples from, and he's been at the market for a few weeks now, bringing many varieties of heirloom apples down from the San Luis Obispo area. And Mike, I feel like we say this every year, but once again, farmers in California have been dealt some pretty crazy weather this year. 2 weeks ago, there was an excruciating heat wave. How are the apples doing?
Well, it's been a wild ride this summer. Actually, it seems like it was 4 weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, we had our first heat wave. And that's the one that had all the lightning storms. And so that kind of set the stage up our way. So it was hot, but it was in the realm of this has happened before, but it lasted. It seemed like almost 2 weeks of heat. It just wouldn't relent. So consequently, all our apple varieties moved forward. They began to ripen early. Then the last heat wave came in, and that's the one with all the record-breaking temperature, a confirmed National Weather Service recording of 120 degrees in San Luis Obispo. I'm sure it was that hot in Sea Canyon. My neighbor said it was 127. I don't know what to say other than it was crazy intense. We have a lot of trees that have burned leaves. Trees that you would think are adapted to heat, like plums, totally scorched. So what does that really mean? Well, we had some drop and we had some fruit burn. But the good news was that the first heat wave pushed a lot of stuff forward, like I was saying. So we kind of got out, and these are the mid-season varieties. And we picked a whole bunch prior to the heat wave. We still had damage. We're kind of digging through it now, but we're okay. I shake my head because this has been the craziest year ever, period. And I think most people can agree with that. And I think at this point too, I'm like, well, is it over yet? I mean, what's next? Because it is only mid-September, and it's not unusual to have one or two more heat waves with Santa Ana winds. Right. So we are not fooling around. We are picking hard. We're moving. So that's the Sea Canyon apple story. And it's been a wild ride, believe me.
I bet. So you're known as a dry farmer. When it gets hot like that, can you irrigate? Do you irrigate? Do you even have the infrastructure to go out there and give the trees water?
So one of my main orchards is, we can't. There's just no water. We established it with the neighbor's water system with drip line, and then we rolled it all back. But that orchard also is composed of a lot of trees on seedling rootstock, and the seedling rootstock can find water underground very easy. I do have other blocks where we can roll drip out if we want to. And I've really been contemplating this whole dry farm situation because we're running into drier weather. That being said, Sea Canyon's got a tremendous amount of underground water and never really had a problem, even during the really long drought, of any of our wells getting too bad. So,
well, that is some good news.
Yeah.
And the table is full of apples now. I mean, so many varieties, beautiful fruit. Give us some highlights this year. Maybe pick one for eating out of hand and one for cooking. What are your favorites?
Well, that is always the most difficult question. But this year, the John Alicious, which is it's a cool variety. We got a lot here today, and they're blowing out. They're really good. They're super crunchy, and they're mildly tart. And they have this kind of deep flavor. It's more of like a wild cherry flavor. I like the Newtown Pippins. They're the old green guys that are killer. Oh, my God, they're so rich. And then what else am I liking out there? Empire. I like Empire quite a bit. But it's like I was saying, some of the old school varieties on the seedling rootstock, they're kind of really showing up this year. The Red Gold, the Striped Red, the Golden Delicious, they've been really good.
Well, it's always so interesting to hear what farmers are up to. I'm glad to hear that you and your apples are doing okay. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
That was Mike Cerrone of Sea Canyon. You can find his apples at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
In a minute, the beauty and hardship of pastry. A writer takes us on a global quest for the best cheesecake, and a pastry chef confronts an industry where for years, profit and fame were valued more than those who toiled behind the stove. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'm Jewish. Cheesecake is in my blood. Right now, truthfully, my refrigerator is mainly dairy products. But somehow I missed the Basque cheesecake train of 2018. I needed to remedy this gap in my culinary game, so I ordered a 4-inch cake pan. I live alone, after all, and made my first tiny Basque cheesecake last night. It wasn't dark enough on top, and it was a little too runny, but I get the obsession now. I even woke up at 4:30 a.m. and walked to the fridge in a trance to get a spoonful. Writer Daniela Galarza fell under its spell as well, and she did the research for Taste. Hi, Daniela.
Hi, Evan.
You've said that there's something ugly beautiful about Basque cheesecake. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Sure. I think usually when people think of cheesecake, they're thinking of like a junior's cheesecake with this pristine white top and very, you know, velvety interior that's all one texture, a really neat and tidy crust. But a Basque cheesecake is burnt on the top. The right way to make it is you're really burning it a little bit, and it's not all one texture on the inside, but that's also what makes it so good.
And it doesn't have a crust.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's even better, I think. It can be gluten-free for people who don't like to eat gluten, and it makes it, you know, one less step, too.
Can you tell us where the Basque cheesecake originated?
Sure. So the Basque country in Spain has a cheesecake that is made with local cheeses and is a pretty lovely, lovely texture. But the style that I think everyone has become really obsessed with is the one from La Viña, a wine bar and restaurant in San Sebastian, Spain. And they're not the first to start using Philadelphia cream cheese in particular to make their cheesecake, but they are the first to make it in this style that produces a cheesecake with a really lovely, like, runny center.
And did you talk to the owner or to the chef that made it for the first time? Did it start out as a mistake?
I did. And I don't think it started out as a mistake. When I became obsessed with it, I decided I needed to go and try to taste it for myself. I went to San Sebastian last year after doing a lot of research online and seeing a lot of videos about it. And when I got to San Sebastian, unfortunately, La Viña was closed for renovations. The owner of the restaurant, Santiago Rivera, was there. But I asked everyone I could. I sort of went hunting for it, and they eventually connected me with Santiago Rivera, who, you know, he was really surprised that rumor at the time was that his cheesecake recipe was a secret. There were a few tourist groups that he was in touch with years ago who started stopping into the restaurant. And of course, everyone loved the recipe. And so he decided, well, why don't I just give it away? You know, there's a video on YouTube of him making it. And there is a recipe that's publicly available if you Google it.
So what are the ingredients in his version?
It's just cream cheese, sugar, eggs, salt, and heavy cream.
So interesting. Have something that the only difference is the temperature. So it tells you how temperature is another ingredient.
Absolutely. But I think the ratio of ingredients has something to do with it, too. I mean, I think that the quantity of eggs feels more to me than in other recipes I've seen. And the addition of heavy cream, I think, can also impact how it sets a little bit. But surely the temperature is key in order to get that darkened top, which gives you another, element of flavor to it. That little sort of burnt char that you get adds something to it that you don't get from regular cheesecake.
So good. It's like a brie.
Yeah.
The texture is like the best, most perfect brie that you ever had in your life, but it's cheesecake.
You know, you could sort of spread it almost, but it's really silky on the inside. It's lovely.
Now, of course, Dave Barron at Dialogue and Pajali here in LA makes a version, and he's famously tight-lipped about his recipe, only giving up two of the five ingredients, sugar and salt. Were you able to extract any details from him?
I was, but actually I should clear up that he did give the LA Times got his recipe, or he said he gave his recipe to the LA Times. But when I interviewed him about this, he said he couldn't give me the recipe because he had promised it to another writer. I didn't know it was the LA Times at the time. And he said that I kept telling him, well, I think it's cream cheese, sugar, eggs, salt. And then, you know, I think maybe it's just egg yolks, or is it whole eggs? And there's got to be another ingredient. And he kept telling me, well, just think about what would make it, you know, super creamy and fresh. And I remember this is him trying to give me a hint, right? And his recipe, which he reverse engineered, does not contain heavy cream, or it contains much less heavy cream, and its other main ingredient is creme fraiche. So when he was saying what would make it taste creamy and fresh, that was him trying to tell me, try creme fraiche, you know. So that was a fun
conversation.
That's
really funny.
And I like talking to chefs. Yeah.
When foods like this become viral and just travel across the world through the chef network really quickly, how do you think that happens? Is it solely social media?
No, I think you touched on another side of it, which is through the chef network. I think, you know, when I was in Santiago, Spain, and I was only there for 4 days, and I didn't tell anyone in the United States that I was going, actually. It was sort of a last-minute trip when I was in London. I ran into three chefs from New York and L.A. when I was there. And so this is already a place, you know, I think these things happen especially when it happens in a town that is already known for its culinary scene, and in the time before the pandemic, when travel was really open, it was sort of known that, you know, you'd go to these places and you'd see what the local community was dreaming up. And I think, you know, Dave Barron in particular, when he was at Next Restaurant in Chicago, that was something that restaurant group did on a regular basis. And I think a lot of restaurant groups used to do on a regular basis, which is sort of go in search of inspiration. And they, you know, went to the Basque Country in search of inspiration, and the cheesecake was just one element that they picked up on. But that said, I mean, I think a lot of chefs passed through that city and were inspired by it in many different ways, and the cheesecake is just one such way. But when it's something that is easy enough that you can make at home, I think then you've got the two-pronged expansion. You know, you've got people like me who are just curious about food and write about food that can sort of help it expand in that way. But you've also got just home cooks who are excited about trying different recipes. And they could have found this, already they could have found this online. And so I think, I think it's been online for about a decade. So it's sort of just been spreading gradually. And I like that social media can kind of help spread that. And I like that it sort of democratizes that spread a little bit.
Thank you so much, Daniela.
Sure, of course. Thanks for having me, Evan.
That's Daniela Galarza, staff writer at The Washington Post. We've been discussing Basque cheesecake, the subject of an article she wrote last year for the website Taste. We all struggle to become ourselves, and then, if we're lucky, to learn to live peacefully within that self. Sometimes I think the restaurant business attracts what we used to call characters, because the work is a way to keep yourself upright and moving and prevent yourself from too much interior reflection. Lisa Donovan found herself as she walked a difficult path, one of early motherhood, an abusive relationship, and poverty. And eventually she found fame and self-worth. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you here. How are you doing in these crazy times?
It's as well as can be expected, I think.
So much of your story is about struggle in the face of fierce independence and poverty. And there was a particularly difficult moment that MFK Fisher's book, How to Cook a Wolf, entered your life. What was happening then?
Oh, gosh. We were raising two kids under the age of five, living in a third floor walk-up with, a few too many animals and a hamster named Burnt Waffle. And we were an artist and a writer come pastry chef baker. And we were trying to just make ends meet as a very working class family in a city and in a country where the working class has disappeared. We were having to pull about three to four jobs each, my husband and I. And we were kind of at this breaking point where we weren't quite sure. We were out of resources. We were out of optimism, frankly. there's a few stories in the book about me, pumping breast milk in the bathroom stall of a cocktail waitressing job. And, you know, things were just starting to feel a little harder than they should. And we were really trying to cling to knowing that we could make it, frankly, to the place that we have made it right now, which is, I get to, write mostly full-time and my husband is an artist full-time. And so, it was that sort of breaking point of us trying to figure out if we were just going to be, delivering Domino's pizzas for the rest of our lives. Not that there's anything wrong with that. That just wasn't what our goals were. And it surely wasn't putting enough bread on the table. So we were kind of at a strange impasse.
And you had an aunt who would send you books and sometimes cases of books. And in this case, one single book, MFK Fisher's How to Cook a Wolf.
Yeah. Oh, what a beautiful book.
So I'm going to just read a quote that you have at the beginning of this section, and then you can pick up with a paragraph. There's a whining at the threshold. There's a scratching at the floor. To work in heaven's name, the wolf is at the door.
I was shown my childhood on a page. I had to grow up a little to see that this story, this whole conversation about giving of yourself, is the story of my mother, likely your mother, your grandmother, my grandmother, me. How to Cook a Wolf's not just a generationally specific way to talk about how to survive hard times, post-war rationing, and community crop sharing. It is the story of how women are bountiful and generous in the face of loss and desperation and need. This story about how we all have been saving one another as women forever is the one that I never knew how to admit was already in my bones because of my mother and her mother and my aunts, and how they saved us the best way they knew how.
So many of us know you as this famed pastry chef who came to national attention with a buttermilk chess pie at Husk. As the underbelly of the restaurant industry continues to be exposed, it's chefs that most people are concentrating on and going after. Mm-hmm. And I think many people expected you to do that to Chef Sean Brock, with whom you worked at Husk, which is where you developed that signature buttermilk chess pie. But instead, you focused your real ire and anger in the book on investor groups. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that?
Oh, I'd love to. Well, look, going back to sort of the original statement you made, like I do think, you know, part of me does know I'm very self-aware. And I do know that if I had, you know, come out with an indictment of all the chefs I'd ever worked for, this would probably be a New York Times bestseller. And there's some, you know, there's something about that that I think is worth mentioning, because I think the attention that things get sometimes is based on the wrong reasoning. And I really wasn't trying to indict anyone in this book. This book for me was about mentioning stories that were important to my own journey of undoing a lot of internalized misogyny and a lot of things that I felt were turning points in my life. But I also think some people feel like it's a little bit of a cop-out and that maybe I gave some people too much grace. And I think that's really unfortunate, because, you know, I think preserving relationships and really trying to allow people the space to build something more than they used to be is also really important in our culture. So I'm a deep pragmatist, and this has historically been an exploitive industry to work within. And I think once you get people with a lot of motivation to make their millions, make more millions, you're taking a system that was already broken to begin with, and you're just basically putting it on steroids. And so, you know, it became, I think working for Sean was more about me getting to peek behind this curtain of people who had, you know, a 20-person investor group, and they would open up these restaurants with, you know, millions of dollars already on top of the heads of their line cooks and their dishwashers. And, you know, the people that were suffering weren't the investors, by and large. You know, it was the workers, and it was the people that were, you know, cranking out two shifts a day, the dishwashers that had to have three other jobs because this one job did not provide for a sustainable lifestyle in any capacity.
Just to put things into context in terms of where you were and what you were experiencing when you were learning these lessons at Husk, how long did you work there?
I reopened Husk. So there was a good 6 to 8 month opening period. And then I was there for about 2 years.
So you were there for 2 years and you were head of a pastry program that included two restaurants. And when you left, how much money were you earning?
So whenever I started there, I was making $15 an hour. I was making $15 an hour throughout. I don't know, there was about 4 to 6 months, 4 to 4 months there where I, as a favor, was asked to go fly back and forth to Charleston and basically give this restaurant group my entire intellectual property. It was sort of this flash in the pan. Can you come train up these kitchens as a favor to teach them how to do all of your pastries and also help them write menus for several months? I was very excited about, you know, the potential of what this meant. This meant that I could potentially rise to an executive pastry chef level. And I kind of saw that doorway being like cracked open a little bit, thinking this is how I get the job that finally I can survive as a pastry chef with. And I wrote a really heartfelt letter to the CEO of the restaurant group saying, look, now's the time. I'm ready. I'm all in. And can we please talk about the potential of this? And, the Charleston job or opportunity, because it wasn't a job, I wasn't getting paid for it. The Charleston opportunity got taken away. They had already had all the recipes, but like that work got taken away. They said, no, we're good. You just go back to your other thing and just worry about this one station. By the time I left, I had asked for a salary. They had finally agreed, but it had to come to the expense of me, you know, basically firing a line cook because they had asked me to bring her down to less than half time. She was full time, and they said, you can have your salary, but you have to basically take this other person down too. So they weren't willing to, you know, it was like I had to take someone else's apples to make my own pie. And I was like, I'm not comfortable. She can't survive this. And that's when I knew I had to go, when it was just, you know, they couldn't even see their way to funding this properly as it was being built. But yet, you know, when they opened that restaurant, they sunk probably $50,000 into an art collection and paid a PR company, you know, God knows how many thousands of dollars a month to win awards. Once you get to that level of expenditures and you're still grappling with your pastry chef, who's become a nationally recognized pastry chef for, you know, a measly $40,000 a year salary after she's already proven, you know, that she has the potential to bring you great notoriety. You know, there's a problem there.
Yeah. Well, we're grateful you left.
Well, thanks. I am too.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa.
Well, thanks for having me, Evan.
That's writer Lisa Donovan. At the advice of legendary Diana Kennedy, she stopped letting men tell her story. Her memoir is Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. Well, the fact that I've eaten at least 20 tortillas this week can only mean one thing. The tortilla tournament is back. Gustavo Arellano's in the studio with me next to tell us what we can expect from this year's Masa Mania. Stay close. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. We may be sticking close to home these days, but eating tortillas is hardly a hardship, even if your assignment is to eat 16 different ones and make judgments about them. Yes, the tortilla tournament is back, and we're doing it virtually. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here to tell us what's in store for this year's Masa Extravaganza. Hello.
Hola, Evan.
Well, I guess first we should announce the name of this contest, which I love in its length. It's officially called KCRW and Gustavo's Great Tortilla Tournament with Good Food's Evan Kleiman.
Whew. It's like there was that old Mad magazine. It was a feature that they would say like silly stories. Then there would be even more silly stories. Then still even more silly stories, even still more. So it's like every year we're just adding more and more and more of it. That just shows how grandiose and amazing the tortilla tournament always is.
So give us a refresher. How is the contest organized?
So think of a sports tournament, or if you don't follow sports, then you do it like this. You have 64 entries, 64 distinct tortillas. We split it up into 32 corn, 32 flour. Then from there, we break it up into groupings of 16. And then we rank them, number 1 through 16. So the best tortillas from last year get the higher rankings. The worst tortillas from this year get the lower rankings. And then you match them up. So number 1 versus number 16, number 2, number 15, and so forth. You match them up. You go round after round after round until we finally get to the finalist, the best corn or the best flour. And then we match them up. And you try to determine who is the best tortilla for this year, corn or flour.
So who created the original seeds?
Oh, that's all me. So if you do not like the seeding of your favorite tortilleria, or you're wondering why your favorite tortilla isn't in this year's tournament or wasn't in last year's tournament, you could blame me. I ate all 64 tortillas, and even more tortillas over the course of the past year, trying to figure out what I thought would be great in this year's tournament. And at the end, I seeded them.
And what are the geographical parameters?
Oh my God. This year, let's see, we go all the way from Ventura. There's a great taqueria there in downtown Ventura, Taqueria Doña Raquel. From there, all the way to Coachella, a tortilleria there, to the San Fernando Valley, where we actually have two people who went very far in the tournament from last year, Sabor a Mexico, actually three, Sabor a Mexico, Lenchitas, and La Talpense. And then all the way, it's kind of a cheat, but Fallbrook, there's a place called Acapico that sells at farmers markets in Orange County, and they make these really good blue corn tortillas. So the purpose is, I mean, for right now, to keep in Southern California, but to always keep expanding slowly but surely. Eventually, one great year, one great glorious year, we'll eventually get to Texas.
So we should say that the judges are you, myself, Connie Alvarez, who is a staff member at KCRW, and Mona Holmes, who writes for Eater LA. And obviously, this year is a little different than usual. I'm curious, how has the COVID-era tortilla experience differed for you personally?
Oh my God. Like, first of all, you have to think about your safety. Before, you want tortillas, you go to your liquor store, your market, or your local tortilleria, you buy them, you come home, you eat them, and that's that. Obviously, this year, you have to be, you know, wear a mask, wear gloves, or at least have hand sanitizer, be socially distanced, but also notice how exactly are they making, like, notice the business that you're, you know, that you're going to patronize. So once, you know, there was one tortilleria in Thousand Oaks that a friend of mine said, oh my God, they make the best flour tortillas. It wasn't a tortilleria, it was a restaurant. So I drive all the way from Santana to Thousand Oaks, even in this, you know, this non-traffic era, it's still quite a distance. And I go in there, very few of the customers are wearing masks. None of the workers are. I walk in there after a minute, I just walked out because there was no way I was going to expose myself to any risk, let alone get tortillas made by those people. And then I don't have flour this year, but then expose yourself or Mona to the possibility of that. So yeah, you have to be more careful than ever before.
So when is the contest?
Well, we're going to start, we're going to announce all the contestants on September 16th, right as close to Mexican Independence Day as possible. Go to kcrw.com/tortilla like every year, and you'll see all the rankings, little bios of everything. And since we are virtual this year, you know, I'm going to be writing a little bit more, a couple more essays, original essays, some reviews and profiles just to get people really looped into not just caring about who's advancing, but some of the stories behind the tortillas. And frankly, that's one of the reasons why we're doing it this year more than ever, because all these businesses, they're small businesses, you know, they're all struggling right now. And that was one of, like, it was so surreal just going out there, like checking on Yelp and realizing that the hours are reduced. So, you know, showing up to a place that's closed or talking to some of the tortillerias and say, oh, well, you have to come if you want the freshest batch, you have to come on this day because we've cut down on production. Because even though you always need tortillas, people are just not buying as many tortillas as they used to.
So give us some teasers. What can we expect in the coming weeks?
Well, you're going to see, of course, old standbys like Sonora Town, Home State, and the flour tortilla category. You have Kernel of Truth and Taco Maria in the corn tortilla category. So they've been, you know, almost at the top since the first year. But you're also going to have some cool newcomers. Like one newcomer that I really like, and you're the one who actually turned me on to them, the Tehachapi Grain Project, which makes really great corn and flour tortillas.
Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias, Evan.
That was the ever prolific Gustavo Arellano, who is now a columnist at the Los Angeles Times. We've got a lot of masa coming your way these next few weeks, so be sure to stay with us as we eat our way to the best tortillas in Southern California. And you can follow along at kcrw.com/tortilla. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My enduring thanks to the Good Food team. They are Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. Lashana Tova, may what lies ahead be sweeter than the dumpster fire we've all been living in. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.